My name is Michael McCusker. Now, following his triumphal impersonation as the only real Yankee Doodle Patriot American on the July 4th Independence Day, entrancing all America with his draft dodger's mangled homage to military glory, as would a little boy playing with toy soldiers, our Nero-Sis-istic president declares his divine right to be the avatar of human rights, in much the manner he has proclaimed himself the superior authority to abolish constitutionally guaranteed birthright citizenship. And like the Caesar, for whom July is named, he and only he can bestow or withdraw any person as an American. So much for the promotional ballyhoo. Now, on with the show. There probably has not been a more necessary cosmic cruciality since the age of revolution that rebirthed democracy, known also as the Age of Enlightenment. To be aware exactly of our rights and obligations as citizens of the world's currently oldest democracy, but also as world citizens. A global concept of humanity as a mutually tolerant and cooperative species that the resurgent ultra-nationalist neo-fascism globally does not recognize in its pernicious descent to history's darkest past, and which it is determined to abolish along with cognate ideas of human rights. We as persons and citizens not only have guaranteed basic human rights as shields against tyranny and despotism, we personally and collectively are obligated to protect those rights. We have the right to defend our rights and the rights of everybody else. While the American Bill of Rights of its Constitution are fundamental laws of the United States, indisputably until only recently, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights act more as aspiration for humanity in general, but are not specifically its reality. Among the most essential provisions of these vital documents are: all humans are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in a spirit of fraternity. And that's the UN Declaration, Article 1. Everyone is entitled to all rights and freedoms without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. And that is UN Article 2. No law shall be made respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free expression thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition for a redress of grievance. And that is the First Amendment of the U.S. Bill of Rights. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. And that is the Union Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 18 and 19. No distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or international status to which a person belongs. And that is UN Article 2, Part 2. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. And that is UN Article 3. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search shall not be violated. And that's the U.S. Fourth Amendment. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. That's UN Article 4. Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. Union Article 23. No person shall be held to answer to a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury of peers, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against themselves, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And that's the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Bill of Rights. To these few, distilled from many, from the U.S. Bill of Rights, 10, and the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights, 30, an addition of Section 20 of the Oregon State Constitution Bill of Rights. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which, upon the same terms, shall not equally belong to all citizens. In addition to the Ten Commandments of the U.S. Constitution, the 14th Amendment, one of the so-called Civil War Amendments, 13, 14, and 15, which was originally passed to provide federal protection for individual rights of slaves freed by the 13th Amendment, has been the major propellant for compliance by the states for the Bill of Rights as a result of its due process clause and equal protection glue that in essence also binds universal and national human rights together. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law." And Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, "The Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this amendment." The United States is a democracy because it is necessary. Freedom and human rights have not been an easy achievement, nor equal justice, anything other than perpetual conflict between those who would expand rights and liberties and others who would limit or abolish them altogether. The USA is not a triumphant example of democracy, but a perpetual work in process and dubious progress, always in revolution and civil war. The original Yankee Doodle ancestors we nominally venerate insisted that basic human rights and freedoms should be the foundations of government and that the nucleus of liberty was to be the vote. Those venerated ancestors anticipated critical events of great tragedy, anxiety, and even internal betrayal, and they realized unscrupulous persons or factions would seize any opportunity to grasp power and dismantle the Constitution and the Bill of Rights in particular. Inherent limits on power were established precisely to curb the avaricious ambitions of many among us, to prevent them from getting their hands on the people's constitutional rights, which makes our rights and freedoms also our obligations to preserve them. Yet the farther removed we are from the intense imperatives of our forebears to safeguard and expand liberty and equality, all for one and one for all, in essence, the more we guileless descendants precariously take for granted what they fought and bled to establish, the greater the probability we will allow them to be disenfranchised and especially denied to our descendants. And always in dispute, are the contrasts between universal emancipation and suffrage, and the uptight upright who believe they deserve freedom and equality, but others do not. In a very real sense, the division between those who believed a Bill of Rights to the Constitution was unnecessary, and the majority who fervently demanded their inclusion was essential, was that the former regarded themselves as the leader class, and the latter refused their spurious claim to superiority, and that enumeration of basic rights of the people was the foundation of liberty and justice for all. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Experience has shown that even the best forms of government, those entrusted with power, have in time perverted it to tyranny." As Jefferson expected, democracy is at present being shaken to its roots, and its survival depends on the very people it was constructed to not only protect, but who are constitutionally mandated as its source of preservation. That is because depravity has fallen upon the USA in the absurd improbability of Donald Trump as president. Once more, as he has since his election and inauguration, which he immediately pronounced as National Patriotic Devotion Day, takes a wrecking ball to the Constitution, and never more so when he profanely declared that he has the power and prerogative to revoke birthright citizenship, cornerstone of the 14th Amendment. His most recent despotic travesty, aside from his usual repellent blowhard racism, misogyny, and perpetual falsehoods, has been to bogusly establish a Commission on Unalienable Rights, and that's a quote, the purpose of which to sift through human rights law and determine which rights are entitled to gain respect, and that is also a quote. The Federal Register claims that this commission would provide fresh thinking about human rights discourse, where such discourse has departed from our nation's founding principles of natural law and natural rights. Aside from the Orwellian newspeak blather, those so-called natural laws and rights that stem from originalist 18th century axioms included chattel slavery and the dehumanization of black people and subjection of women, and are also God whistles, dog spelled backward, for militant, even inquisitory, religion. Modern human rights are grounded in the dignity inherent in every human being, Roger Cohen wrote in the New York Times, decrying this new and unlawful inquisition of human rights. They are not God-given rights or Trump-given rights. And that was Roger Cohen. Trump's purpose is to examine, and that's a quote from himself, America's fundamental human and democratic rights and prune those he considers unnecessary and unpatriotic. The patriotism Trump extols as patriotic is to not ask questions about him or his presidency and to be supportive and ultimately submissive to his erratically empirical unraveling of democracy. Unquestioning support and obedience is the patriotism Trump insists upon. Trump and his vaunted base of ultra-right-wing white supremacist nationalists arrogantly and deceitfully attempt to coerce the American public into thinking it is unpatriotic to defend or protect political rights and civil liberties, while in the meantime, these blatantly misogynistic Morlocks go about dismantling the basic fundamentals of democratic governance and basic human rights. Human rights law has made concern for the freedom and welfare of individuals and vulnerable groups legitimate, Bard A. Andreessen wrote in the Oxford Encyclopedia of Human Rights. However, he wrote, it remains challenged by the power of states and non-state actors that pursue interests that violate human rights standards. The UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights were conceived in 1948, 3 years after the end of World War II and the defeat of Nazi Germany's attempt to enslave Earth for its insane dream of a thousand-year totalitarian empire. The defining goal for a grievously wounded humanity was, as stated in the Declaration's prologue, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, in which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind. In retrospect, these human rights are more aspirational than reality, a prospect of what humanity might or ought to be, rather than the actuality of what it is. Yet the Declaration's ultimate possibility is a clarion call for the perception that humanity must evolve beyond its self-inflicted horror upon itself, if it is to avoid its suicide as a species from both war and catastrophic human-induced climate disaster and collateral devolution. You might remember that Eleanor Roosevelt was in charge of the UN Commission that drafted the Declaration of Human Rights. Her late husband, Franklin Roosevelt, perceived a more locally pertinent second Bill of Rights during World War II. 1. A job. 2. An adequate wage and decent living. 3. A decent home. 4. Medical care. 5. Economic protection during sickness, accident, old age, or unemployment. 6. A good education. 3 newspaper headlines from the U.S. edition of The Guardian paraphrase this whole story. 1. Donald Trump is on an Orwellian mission to define human rights. 2. President Trump says only Trump supporters deserve free speech. And 3. Trump revives the idea of white man's country, America's original sin. And now, I would like to read something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle. 25 years ago, when 14 hotshots were killed on a forest fire in Colorado in July 1994. 9 of them were from a Pineville, Oregon hotshot crew. That was the same year Smokey the Bear celebrated his 50th birthday. I titled it, Dying Like Squirrels. Norman McLean might never have realized how swiftly his posthumously published book, Young Men and Fire, would become useful and perhaps necessary to explain the deaths in early July 1994 of more than a dozen forest firefighters. McLean is more recognized by his very popular book that Robert Redford made into a movie, A River Runs Through It. He was, however, obsessed with the 1949 Montana forest fire that killed 11 smoke jumpers. He spent years researching and tramping over the killing ground of the August 10 Man Gulch fire of 53 years ago, and exhaustively interviewed to enduring friendship the survivors who escaped the terrible deaths of their comrades. McLean wrote in Young Men in Fire, "Burning to death on a mountainside is dying at least 3 times. First, considerably ahead of the fire, you reach the verge of death in your boots and your legs. Next, as you fall, you sink back in the region of strange gases and blue darts where there is no oxygen, and here you die in your lungs. Then you sink in prayer into the main fire that consumes you, and if you are Catholic, about all that remains of you is your cross." The men and women who were incinerated in July 1994 while fighting a forest fire in Colorado were members of hotshot crews. Being a hotshot in the U.S. Forest Service is equivalent to the hard-ass, perpetually hardship infantry. And though the media claims hotshots are elite firefighting crews, they are probably still treated like the infantry. If any possessed intelligence, none would be either, is the traditional attitude. In the past, at least, hotshots were the dogs of the Forest Service. hardly more classy than prison crews sent out to fight the same fires. Hotshots battle their enemy with hand weapons just as dog-faced soldiers, axes, brush hooks, Pulaskis, McLeods, and shovels with which they chop, hack, and scrape trails through the burning wilderness. Wildfire is their enemy, inhuman in contrast to soldiers' nemesis. Sinewy, monstrous, incredibly dangerous and threatening, hot as the sun, grasping for fuel and oxygen to remain alive, sucking human lungs dry at the same instant its intense heat evaporates blood and tissue. Which is what happened to 14 hotshots on a fire in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, working a hotline on a two-bit tree fire that suddenly exploded into a whirlwind inferno and trapped 50 firefighters. Most escaped, though barely. 9 of the 14 dead were from an Oregon hotshot crew based in Prineville, 5 men and 4 women, John Kelso, Bonnie Holby, and Terry Hagen from Prineville, Rob Johnson and Doug Dunbar from Redmond, Levi Brinkley from Burns, Kathy Beck from Eugene, Tammy Bickett from Powell Butte, and Scott Blecka from Clatskanie. If it is any consolation, they probably died instantly, consumed as quickly as if a bomb had fallen on them. When each flared like a match, they were already dead from the fire's lung-sucking heat billows, dehydrated crisper than potato chips. 10 years and 5 days after the cremations of the smoke jumpers in Montana in 1949, 15 members of a luckless Southern California hotshot crew blundered into a box canyon while seeking a tactical advantage over a wildfire. The fire caught them there, and every one of the hotshots died, though the number of dead is disputed. The 11 who died in 1949 are said to be the most deaths of a forest fire crew on a single fire until July 1994. Yet, witnesses on other hotshot crews who futilely attempted to rescue the dead hotshots that summer of 1959 and instead searched for their charred remains are certain 15 died. Years later, men who failed to save the doomed hotshots claim to have heard screams from their inflamed peers. Unless a subliminal empathy of terror connected the dying with their helplessly thwarted rescuers, it was impossible to hear any noise but the roar of the fire, which could be compared with hurricane surf heard from inside a sea cave. Puny human squeals of terror would be unheard. Past and recent deaths of smoke jumpers and hotshots, at least 20 died the summer of 1994, underscore the grim reality that fighting forest fires is incredibly dangerous and is rated the most deadly occupation of government employ, with the exception of wartime combat service. The smoke jumpers at Man Gulch died like squirrels, McLean wrote. So did the 15 hotshots in 1959, and everyone fried out of life on a wildfire. It should not end there, he said, smoke drifting away and leaving terror without consolation of explanation and controversy without lasting settlement. Probably most catastrophes end this way without an ending, the dead not even knowing how they died, but still alertly erect in fear and wonder, those who loved them forever questioning this unnecessary death, and the rest of us tiring of this inconsolable catastrophe and turning to the next one. And that was something I wrote, Dying Like Squirrels. I spent a few seasons as a member of the Dalton Hotshots, Mount Baldy District, Angeles National Forest, U.S. Forest Service, 1959 to 1961. And this article appeared in the August 1994 North Coast Times-Eagle. And as I said earlier, that year, Smokey Bear celebrated his 50th birthday. And I was in both infantries. I was in firefights, and I was a firefighter. Two different things. And now I would like to read a poem, Summer's Children. It's by Richard Shelton. We do not know who chose us, but we are the chosen. We were chosen not to be you. We enter your cities like fog, with our bedrolls and our portable lives, our ragged coats always too big, the better for sleeping in. We follow summer, and we all look alike to you. With our uncombed hair, we look like winter. When we are young, we look older. When we are older, we begin to look young. You do not want to look at us, and since we are invisible to you, we can urinate anywhere. We are not lost. We know where we are, but our itinerary is chance and weather. We do not believe in destinations, and we are in no hurry. We have learned patience from statues in 1,000 parks and joy from dogs without collars. We envy you nothing you want. We can live on what you throw away. We envy only birds of passage, their ability to fly. Sometimes we ask for your spare change, but never your credit cards. Otherwise, we keep our distance, avoiding the germs of your misery. The wolf does not come to our doors. We have no doors. We have lost our name somewhere and are required to sign nothing. We do not pay taxes. We feed the birds. We do not vote. Why should we vote for you? We do not join the army. We are an army, and we will not fight in your wars. We have lost our return addresses, our forwarding addresses, our social security numbers, and are secure in our own society. We leave messages to one another on the undersides of bridges in a code you cannot decipher, but we plot to overthrow nothing. We escape. We are summer's children, born into your winter. We are not a problem. We are a solution to a problem. You are the problem. And that was Summer's Children by Richard Shelton. And this is Michael McCusker.